Shalom. This is Reverend John Ferret, and we are in lesson 23 in the podcast series, The Gospel According to Moses, the Book of Exodus. As you're aware, I play as the intro music, Hatikva, which is the Hebrew word for the hope. It's Israel's national anthem, and they certainly will remember their great deliverance by Adonai out of Egypt and out of the bondage of slavery. And so indeed their hope constantly is in the God of Israel. And so this is why I play it as we're in Exodus. And this entire story of the Exodus here in Torah is that basis for the Jewish people and their constant hope, not only then, but even now, for their deliverance and their safety and security and their salvation. But for us too. You're going to see this, how related it is to this in this lesson. I was just amazed. I was in awe in terms of preparing for this lesson. That in one chapter of the book of Exodus, he took me from Genesis all the way to the book of Revelation. He showed me his hope. He showed me Hatikva, our hope in him. You'll see what I mean. Now in lesson 22, prior to this, we dealt with two topics. We were dealing with Exodus 7, verse 3, where God was going to be talking about harden Pharaoh's heart. And it doesn't say that. It says that God will make Pharaoh's heart heavy. And God did not harden his heart. It's all based upon the great work of Rabbi Sforno in the 16th century. And basically, he basically showed us the Hebrew. And he showed us an equivalent alternative translation that God indeed made Pharaoh's heart heavy. And we need to take a look at it from a Hebraic point of view and an Egyptian point of view. And the fact is that God helps us, that he loves Pharaoh, and he will not take away anybody's free will. So again, as I mentioned in that lesson, for more in-depth study, I have two videos that are entitled His Highness's Heavy Heart. They're at the website, or not at the website, but if you go to the website, www.lightamenorah.org, and remember, menorah spelled M-E-N-O-R-A-H, light of menorah, all one word, .org. You'll see the YouTube icon either on the right or left. If you click on that, you go to the Light of Menorah video channel on YouTube, and you'll see all our titles there. But you will see video one and video two, part one and part two of the videos on His Highness's Heavy Heart. Now, the second thing we covered in lesson 22 is we talked about Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron and staffs and serpents. Now, this is very important as we're about to enter the 10 plagues. So the staff and the snake event, it sets the stage for what's to come. But how? We're going to see that now and in more detail in lesson 24. That event of the staff and the snakes and the staff of Aaron eating the staffs of the magicians, almost like the snake that the staff became in Aaron's hand, ate the snakes or the serpents of the magicians. So we'll take a look at that, not only in lesson 24, but here indeed in lesson 23 as well. We're in Exodus chapter 7, verses 14 through 25. And let me read those verses from the New American Standard. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Now I just want to bring up the information here. In the New American Standard, it said Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. The word there in Hebrew is kavod. And the Strong's number is H3515, and it has the conceptual idea of heaviness. Now again, from the video series that I just mentioned, and we go into the Hebrew of heaviness, something's definitely not easily moved. However, in the Egyptian culture, if your heart is light, that gives you the impression that you're righteous before Ma'at. Ma'at is the concept of truth, the concept of harmony, the concept of things that are right. And she's a goddess in Moses' time, Ma'at. And so if your heart is light, Ma'at will look upon you as being righteous. If your heart is heavy, you are unrighteous before the great goddess Ma'at. So God is saying here, Pharaoh's heart is heavy, but not heavy towards Ma'at, heavy towards the Hebrews. Again, take a look at those videos as you'll get into more in depth of the Egyptian point of view of all of this concept of God hardening Pharaoh's heart. Anyway, back to the verses. So go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile, and you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. You shall say to him, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, 'Let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness.' But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it will be turned to blood. The fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, and over their pools, and over all their reservoir of water, that they may become blood. And there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone.' So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. And he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of the servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. The fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile, and the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened," actually strengthened. He gave courage to his heart. "And he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this." So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. So this is the first plague. And Dennis Prager, in his Torah commentary on the Exodus called the Rational Bible, he talks about the three purposes of the plagues, as we're going to be entering to them, and we read just about the first one. He says the first and most obvious is to force Pharaoh and the Egyptians to release the Hebrews. The second purpose of the plagues is to punish Pharaoh and the Egyptians for the terrible suffering they inflicted on the Israelites over hundreds of years. And the third purpose of the plagues is to demonstrate to the Israelites and to the Egyptians and to us that God, not the gods of Egypt, including Pharaoh, is the real God. That is why, as we shall see, the plagues were specifically directed against the gods. So this battle is not just God versus Pharaoh or God versus the Egyptians. This battle is against the gods of Egypt. You can read that in Exodus 12:12. This is where God declares it. Also in Numbers 33:4. And from a big picture sense, God is really combating the idea of the worship of nature. Kind of goes all the way back to Genesis. If you remember in Genesis 3, God shows his power over the snake. And it's not a snake, actually. The actual Hebrew word there is serpent. And when you actually take that Hebrew word and you translate it to the Greek word is drakon, which is normally meaning dragon. Now that gets very interesting because we go to Revelation chapter 12 and verse 3, Satan is considered the great red drakon, dragon, bringing it back to the Hebrew serpent, which is exactly what was in the garden. So here God showing his power over nature, over this beast, this serpent in the garden. So indeed, it seems like there's a big picture going on here. And all the gods of Egypt were nature gods. I highly recommend a Christian scholar by the name of David Padfield, P-A-D-F-I-E-L-D, David Padfield. And his website at his church is padfield.com. Brilliant work, just brilliant, of the Bible and its historical context. You can find so much there. Pictures of Israel and Egypt and articles, great teaching. And he's got one called Against All the Gods of Egypt. And as we take a look at his work, he documents that there were over 1,500 gods and goddesses in Egypt at the time of the Exodus. And they were related to the Egyptian society in all aspects of society, from government to farming to military to family life. And the Egyptian gods, they were represented by the bull, the ox, the lion, the ram, the cobra, the crocodile. Now, it's very interesting. These are all beasts. Now, I want to do this specifically as we continue on in this lesson. The Hebrew word for beast, for animal, for wild animals, is behemah. And the Strong's number is H929. So what we have here is the gods of Egypt were representative by beasts, by animals, by wild animals. Amun-Ra, the great sun god of these times when Moses and Aaron confronted Pharaoh and then finally the Exodus. He's represented by a ram. Hathor, she's the cow goddess. Anubis, the god of the underworld, the jackal. Horus, the great god who supposedly represents Pharaoh, is represented by a falcon. Or Bastet, the cat goddess. Or Hekhet, the frog goddess. The gods of Aegis are behemoth, to be precise in terms of the plural. They're animals, they're beasts. Beasts of nature. Now, you've heard me reference, again, the great Jewish intellectual, staunch conservative and Bible scholar, Dennis Prager. He's got a video that you can see at YouTube called The Most Important Verse in the Bible. You go to YouTube and you type in the most important verse of the Bible, you will get that. It is just awesome. And in there, he brings up the critical issue in Genesis 1:1, that God created nature, but all pagan gods come out of nature. And technically speaking, pagan worship, pagan religions of this time were basically all religions were worshiping nature. When you study the creation accounts, for instance, of Egyptian mythology, you find out there are five cosmologies. I won't go into all the details. This information is found all over the internet. If you go into cosmology, Egyptian cosmology, you can study this for yourself. But there is one common aspect to the five cosmologies in Egyptian mythology. And what I'm talking about is the five creation accounts. There's a common element to all of these. And that is the primordial sea, the primordial ocean, the waters that existed. And this is termed the god Nun. There was darkness. There was Isfit, and Isfit from the hieroglyphics of ancient Egypt might be termed chaos. In other words, conditions that do not promote life. The absence of life, the absence of conditions that promote good life or safe life. There was darkness, there was Isfit, there was water. But out of Nun, out of this chaos, this Isfit, this darkness, out of this darkness and void where there is no life, all the gods of Egypt are created. Now you can go to YouTube and you can type in Egyptian creation myth, and you'll find a really cool short video, about 5 minutes, that takes a look at the basic elements of these cosmologies, these creation stories. Also, Dr. John Caried, many of you know already that Dr. John Caried is one of my key scholars that I reference in his Torah commentary. But he wrote an outstanding book, which I have read twice already. Dr. John Caried, and the book is Ancient Egypt and the Old Testament. You guys, I'm telling you, you got to get this book and read it. It is just amazing. Because again, Dr. Caried talks about ancient Egypt and the Old Testament, and his study is just awesome. One of the things that he shows is the relationship between what I just discussed, that is the god Nun, where there was darkness, no life, Isfit, which is the absence of conditions for good life or safe life, and water. But we go into Genesis chapter 1, and it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Now in here in the Hebrew, where it says the earth was formless and void, that means tohu ve bohu, tohu and bohu, and darkness. Now tohu and bohu means emptiness, formless, nothing, no life, water, and darkness. It's the same conditions. But the difference, as Dr. Caried actually points out, is God creates this. Where in the Egyptian cosmologies, in the Egyptian creation stories, the gods of Egypt come out of the darkness and come out of the tohu and bohu. So we have to recall one of the major goals of this study is to ask ourselves the question, if the Hebrews are coming out of Egypt and they had assimilated into the Egyptian culture and into the false religions of Egypt, and you can go back into previous lessons. I can't, I think it's lesson 3, 4, or 5, where I go into this in depth, where the Bible really indicates quite strongly that they assimilated into the culture. And they were the first ones to hear God's word, his instruction, his teaching, or his Torah, not law. Torah means instruction. They heard this. And now, for them, understanding the 5 creation accounts, or maybe the one that was most popular in the days of Moses, in and around the mid 15th century BC, here are these Hebrews, and here Genesis 1, verses 1 through 2 goes 180 degrees against the Egyptian religion. Our God created Isfit. Before there was anything, he creates the water and the darkness. There's conditions where life cannot be sustained. There's nothingness. And God creates that. But in the Egyptian cosmologies, in the Egyptian creation stories, their gods come out of this, and there's no record, no indication that their gods created what our God created. So again, what's God teaching them, the Hebrews, coming out of Egypt? He is all-powerful. He is above and beyond all the gods of Egypt. Thus it is clear, we're ready to enter the awesome battle of the gods. Battle of God against the idea of lifting up nature. and aspects of nature as God. Now, the battle hasn't ended. It still goes on. These events of 3,400 years ago, they are so related to today. And they're so related to the end times. We talk about PETA, the people for the ethical treatment of animals. And some of those that are so bizarre in PETA that they lift up animals to be equal to us, humans. Or there is the concept called dendrophilia, the love of trees. There's some bizarre stuff you can find on the internet, but there are people who worship Mother Earth and to desire to have an intimate relationship with Mother Earth, so they have sexual relationship with trees. This is the practice of dendrophilia in the extreme. Today, it seems like all obstacles to our behavior and all restrictions are completely thrown off. Nature religion, which we call pantheism, that seeing God in nature, oh, God is in the tree, God is in the grass. And the pagan cults that are weird, and I mean just are practicing abhorrent rituals and practices. It's happening today. The worship of nature. And it's also very interesting when we talk about global warming. Not only has man caused the global warming, but now politics has taken this on, and now you get the impression that the worldview is that we can stop this? Oh my gosh. This is exactly what was going on in Egypt. Pharaoh's job, Pharaoh's main role as the king of Egypt was to prevent Isfit, to prevent chaos. In other words, to prevent that which would be against good life, prosperous life. He is to maintain ma'at. He is to maintain truth and order and justice and harmony. He is to maintain so that life can go on in a prosperous and a beautiful way. That's exactly what's going on today with global warming. That we are somehow lower than Mother Earth, and it's up to us to do everything we can so that indeed we can stop the global warming. So the story isn't over. The battle goes on. Dennis Prager has done a marvelous audio series. It took him 25 years to complete. It's not in his books. And his 25-year Torah study. And he talks about the fact that when you're actually studying these verses, this chapter in Exodus, Exodus chapter 7, he comes up with the fact that indeed God is personal, moral, and holy. However, when we get into nature as opposed to God, nature is not personal, nature is not moral, and nature is not holy. Nature has no relationship to being a deity, especially the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob and the God of Israel, the all-powerful God, the God who is creator, the great king of the universe. Nature's not personal. And again, Dennis Prager, thank you so much for his discussion of this on his audio series. And I'm just trying to review some of the things that he brought because it was so important. Nature is not personal. It doesn't give us a hoot about us and who you are. I remember this. Dennis Prager and myself, not that we did it together, I have been on safari in Kenya. So has Dennis Prager. And we went there on safari to shoot animals, not to shoot, but to actually take our cameras. That was our weapon. And there you actually basically see the one main cardinal rule and the only rule, the only law of nature, and that is survival of the fittest. There's no individual rights. For a baby zebra, that baby zebra doesn't have individual rights. A slow zebra, a zebra that might be totally healthy but is a little slower than the others, there's no individual rights. The slow ones, the babies, the lame ones, they're going to get eaten and slaughtered. There's no compassion. And I remember us, we were on safari and we were there in the Serengeti. And we drove, come to a clump of trees, and there were a pride of lionesses around their kill. They had slaughtered and tore apart a small zebra. It wasn't a baby, it was a young one. So the unprotected, the weak, the young babies, they are going to be slaughtered. And the lioness? Who cares? What is the lioness saying? I catch it, I rip it apart, and I eat it. The forces in nature are impersonal. When the hurricane comes, it doesn't care what it's going to hit, or their tornado, or a blizzard. One of the things that we remember is Jesus seems to teach this. This is Matthew 5, verse 45. And he said, the sun shines on the good and the evil. And it rains on the good and the evil. Nature doesn't care. There's a saying in the Jewish culture, greater is the day of rain than the day of the resurrection of the dead. Listen to this. This is great. Greater is the day of rain than the day of the resurrection of the dead. For the resurrection of the dead is only for the righteous and only for the just. However, the day of rain is for all, the just and the unjust, the evil and the good. And that's true, technically speaking. So in nature, the forces can't be influenced. There's no choices. There's no freedom. The Greeks and the Romans, this is an amazing study in itself. In the pagan ancient cultures, they practiced infanticide. And they had civil rules, civil laws that stated you could kill your children by drowning, by abortion, or infant exposure. In other words, taking your baby outside the city walls and dropping them off at the dung heap and just let them die from exposure. Who cares about the baby? The baby's weak, it's powerless, it's a bother. It inhibits our success. It's like the lioness. Lioness is always concerned about my needs, my desire, the survival of the fittest. So indeed, nature is not personal. Nature is not moral. God's moral, but nature is not moral. How can you worship nature that's not moral? Now, morality, again, is the classification of that which is good and bad, so that you can determine what's good and what's bad. Now, nature only has one rule, and that is survival of the fittest. Love your neighbor as yourself is completely out. Take an example again that, again, Dennis Prager for this whole discussion. He said in World War II, in the concentration camps, German shepherds were trained to attack and maul Jewish prisoners. I mean, it was awful. But the dogs, they're only programmed to do this. They're trained, no choice. That's what they are. Dogs can be trained. They weren't doing anything good or bad because dogs can be programmed. They did it to get a reward. And again, they're neither good nor blind. What about dogs that help the blind? They've been programmed. They're not a good dog. They're not a bad dog. I mean, but from a human perspective, we could say, wow, look who has trained them to do good things as the perception of mankind thinks of doing good things. Not the way the dog. The dog is just trained. So ethical behavior for a dog, ethical behavior, in other words, good behavior for a dog, is doing what they are programmed to do by their trainer. Mauling Jews in the concentration camp, from the dog's perspective, was good. It's good ethics, only for the simple reason they were obeying their master. For us, it's totally unethical, because our ethics, our morality, is separate from nature. So indeed, nature is not moral. That's just a small example. Nature's not holy. God is holy. Now, I'm going to return to the Hebrew, because the word holy in Hebrew is kadosh, and it means set apart, special, set aside, separate, not something that's common, not something that's usual. Now, in nature, there's nothing special. It surrounds us. It's common. It's every day. Some will say, wait a minute, John, what about those hurricanes that come up and hit Florida or the Gulf? Some of those things are just unbelievable. The great hurricanes that we've got them on historical record. Those are special. Those are set aside. No, they're not. It's nature. We should expect it to happen. And again, Jesus' statement in Matthew 5:45 seems to indicate that indeed the rain falls on the good and the evil. The sun shines on the good and on the evil. The kadosh, being holy, is what is not usual and what is not our everyday experience. Now, all of this is critical to know the foundation of what we're about to study. We're about to go in the 10 plagues. We've already read one. We'll read it again in lesson 24. But I'm trying to set the stage. But on top of that, I think what we're looking at, and like I said, Dennis Prager suggested, and I tend to agree, that when we're here talking about Exodus and we're talking about the battle of the gods, God does, it says specifically in Exodus 12:12 that he is about to execute judgment on the gods of Egypt. That when we expand this to look at the big picture, God is against nature worship. And we can see this from Genesis 1:1 all the way to Revelation 22:21. God created the gods. God created all nature. He created the ox. He created the ram. He created trees and bees and locusts. He created serpents. He created snakes. The tarantula. He created mosquitoes. I got a lot of questions about that. And the gods of Egypt come out of nature. They were animals. They were beasts. They were wild animals. They came out of the primordial sea. When you actually study Egyptian creation accounts, and thus God is showing his power and his authority over the gods of Egypt. But remember what I said. I said that the battle isn't over. It goes on. God showed his power right there in the garden in Genesis 3 over the serpent. You know it, a snake. But the actual Hebrew word there is serpent, which in the Greek means dragon, and we take it all the way to Revelation. There's something very interesting that I'd like you to see. I'm going to go to Revelation 13. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 4. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Who's the dragon? When you read it in Revelation, it is Satan. It is the devil. And the dragon, going back to the Hebrew, is the serpent. It's the same word used in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, snake is not used, serpent, which is translated to the Greek and finally to the English is dragon. Then the dragon, seemingly for us, the same one that appeared back in Genesis, is now here. He's standing on the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power. Who? Satan, the dragon, the serpent. And his throne had great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him? The beast came out of the sea. And the Greek word for beast is theirion. Strong's number is G2342. Theirion, an animal, a wild animal. Not a man, not a human. An animal, a wild animal came out of the sea. This reminds us of Egypt. Did John have this in mind? Now let's go to Revelation 13, verses 11 through 16. Then I saw another beast, Therion. And remember, Therion is the Greek word. Strong's number is G2342, which means a wild animal, a beast. That's not a man, not a human. But when you go to Thayer's Greek lexicon, Thayer's will tell us that Greek word, what Hebrew word did it translate into the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. And if you recall, we used the word earlier in this lesson, behemah, H929, beast or animal. So I saw another animal, wild animal, behemah, coming out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. He exercises all authority of the first beast in his presence. And he makes the earth and those who dwell in it worship the first beast, whose fatal wound was healed. You guys, this is like a repeat of Egypt. These are not men coming out of the sea. They are not men coming out of the earth. It's like a repeat of Egyptian creation stories. These are animals, wild animals, nature beasts coming out of the sea, coming out of the earth. Who created the sea? Who created the earth? Our God. Seems like there's a message all the way from Genesis, all the way through the book of Revelation. And in Exodus, we're only seeing the continuing battle, that God is all-powerful. He's mighty. He is over the gods of Egypt. He is over all nature gods. He is over the beasts in Revelation, who are not men, who are not human, but they're beasts. But the Lord defeated, we know, all of the gods of Egypt. He defeated the beast, the wild animal, the serpent, the dragon in the garden. And we already know in the book of Revelation, God has inspired John to tell us that Jesus himself will defeat the great red dragon, the great beast, Satan. Battle of the gods, it doesn't begin in Egypt. It began in Genesis 3. Already God has shown just in the previous lesson that Pharaoh's authority is gone. Aaron's staff ate the staff of the magicians. The staff is the sign of authority. And all of a sudden, we have the message coming to Pharaoh and all of Egypt that the staff of God, this is the authority, the symbol of authority. But Pharaoh's protection is in the goddess Wajet, the cobra goddess. She is the protector. And the staff of Aaron, which was a snake, had eaten the staffs of the magicians, which were snakes. It's almost so we have a double message going on here. Pharaoh's protection was gone. And now we're going to be entering the battle of the gods, and Pharaoh doesn't even know his authority is gone and his protection is gone. It's time to show the Lord's power over Egypt. Time to show the power of God over their source of life, the Nile. And for us, it's a picture of the final defeat of the worship of nature. So our hope, Hatikva, is in the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob and the God of Israel, the Creator God, the great King in the universe, our Yeshua, HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah, Jesus the Christ. So we'll end off again with Hatikva, the hope, the national anthem of Israel. And may it be for us a piece of music that reminds us of our hope in Jesus. I'll see all of you in lesson 24. Shalom.